VGA to whatever. Oh, I see a hand. Great, because we could use one for a presentation this afternoon. Anyway, some of you are probably familiar with this project. We presented on the project at the Santa Barbara, or the pilot project for this at the Santa Barbara conference back in 2002. But this project really started back in the late 1990s. And it was one of the first, when I arrived in Santa Barbara, it was one of the first collections that I identified as a potential candidate for digitization. And there were really four reasons why I thought this would be a good collection to do this. The first was that the cylinders have a legitimate need for preservation, unlike, say, shellac discs or LPs, which really can sit on the shelf forever and not really deteriorate, but the cylinders are really an active mode of deterioration and need transfer and copying. The second reason was that I thought it would be sexy to potential funders, that there's something about cylinders which people, their ears sort of perk up, where if you talk about LPs or shellac, you know, it puts you to sleep sometimes, but no offense, Peter, it didn't put us to sleep. But I thought there was a sexiness there with the cylinders that would appeal to funding agencies. The third was that cylinders really have the fewest copyright problems. You have the Edison cylinders, which, while they're not necessarily in the public domain, the copyrights are owned by the federal government, so we could put them up without worrying about that. And the fourth one was really the limited scope of the collection. Now, a collection of 7,000 cylinders doesn't really sound limited, but compared to, doing a digitization project with shellac discs, where you'd really have to do a subset, and you'd have to decide, am I going to do it by label, or by artist, or by musical style, or time period, or something like that, that we just decided, well, we can do the whole collection. So that was another factor. The second step, then, we acquired an Archaeophone in 1999 in anticipation of doing some sort of digitization project. And then Noah Polacek here came out from Oberlin College in 2002 in January and did his winter term project at the library doing the pilot project where we digitized 65 of the cylinders and put them online. And that was more successful than we thought, and that encouraged us to go after grant funding. And we received grant funding from the Institute of Museum and Library Services in 2003 for the project. Just a few highlights of the grant. The grant then started in December 2003 when we hired Noah to come back out after he had finished college to do the digitizing for the entire collection, and it ran from December 2003 to April 2006. It was originally a 24-month project, but we extended it to 30 months, partly just because the cylinders kept pouring in and turning up under cracks and things like that. The total project cost is about $400,000, $205,000 of which was provided by the federal government, and the rest was in cost sharing and contributed money from the UCSB libraries. That works out to about $60 a cylinder, which just may be a kind of an interesting figure there for to compare to other sorts of digitization projects. The project was done with roughly two and a half FTE, full-time equivalent employees. We had a full-time cataloger, we had Noah, the audio technician, we had systems and programming staff, we had student staff that worked on sorting and rehousing the collections, and then there was myself, the project manager. The initial website went online in November 2005 with a selection of 5,000 cylinders from the collection. Since November of last year, we've added about 1,000 more cylinders to the site, and we continue to add cylinders really almost on a daily basis to the site. And the project will continue indefinitely, we hope, with library support and private donations. This was, for me, kind of the fun thing as a curator, is that I didn't really have to curate anything. We decided to digitize the entire collection, which is right now about 6,600 cylinders. So there were no painstaking decisions on whether something was a good performance or whether there was musically worthy or anything like that. We just threw it up online and figured that that our users would curate their own collections. Here's a rough breakdown that you can see here, and you can see the vast majority, well, not the majority, but a large portion of them are Edison Blue Amber, all the celluloid cylinders. There's also a very large selection of Edison 2-minute wax. Edison 4-minute wax is not complete, but as if you know that body of cylinders, it's a darn lot of them. And then you get decreasing numbers of other cylinders like Indestructible, Columbia, some brown wax, language pathés, and concerts, things like that. So that's a rough breakdown. The first step in the process was to sort and rehouse the cylinders. The students did a lot of this work where we sorted the cylinders by type, so all the blue amberols go on one table, et cetera, and then sorted them by cylinder number and began to compare for duplicates and check condition, takes, and things like that. We housed them in boxes that we helped design with Metal Edge, who's a vendor for archival library supplies. And we did keep the original boxes if there was anything of note on the box, whether it's a lid with title information, original slip that came in it. Some of the boxes do have artifactual value, and we kept them. And then boxes that had numbers handwritten on the side. But most of the boxes, like blue amberol boxes, are all exactly the same. We kept them, but we didn't keep them with the cylinder. The box is a polyethylene support tube, prevents contact with the grooves, and it's an acid-free enclosure. Some of you have seen this box before, and there are a couple disadvantages with it, which I'll be forthright about. One, it's expensive. The second one is it turned out to be more difficult to open than the prototype would have indicated. The lid is a very tight fit, and we all have lots of hangnails and broken fingernails from getting these things open. So we're all looking forward to the cylinder box project that is underway from the cylinder subcommittee of ARSC. And let's see, then we compared alternate takes on this, and this really turned out to be one of the most fascinating parts of the project, I think, and something that I don't think has really been investigated fully with cylinder recordings. In our collection of 6,600 cylinders, there are roughly about 400 alternate takes in that collection. And the takes were identified in several different ways. They were differentiated by the dots, which is the way Edison did it, numbers as Columbia did it, and oftentimes just with visual inspection. Early Edison cylinders don't have any indication of alternate takes, and the only way to do it is either to play it or to measure it. If you look at this right here, you can see that on the rim here, right after the patent, there are two dots which indicate escape two, and then we have three dots here, which indicates escape three. Then you have mole numbers out here. This is mole number 7 and mole number 18. We didn't keep different mold cylinders made from different molds. It's an identical performance, and there are people that are interested in mold numbers and things like that, and they do tell you a bit about how many copies of the cylinder was produced, but we didn't save mold numbers. I'm just going to play. I hope this works. We had a little trouble, but in some cases we found 3 or 4 alternate takes. Some, if they were Edison flat rim cylinders, you couldn't tell at all. This is 3 different takes of Arthur Collins doing Any Rags. This is second another take. Anyway, you could tell the last one in particular, which had a different announcer, was not self-announced, and the orchestra sounded different. I believe the last one was a beveled rim cylinder, and the first two were flat rim cylinders, so they would have been separated by several years in time span. But I think this is a really exciting and relatively unexplored area, is these early alternate takes. And I think the problem is that with shellac discs, you have pretty clear take markings on Columbias and Victors and things like that. But especially with the early Edisons, which don't have take indications on them, I don't think there's ever been enough cylinders sort of in one room for people to say, oh, in fact, yours is different than mine. With those first two, until you listen to them side by side, you wouldn't know. I mean, if Bill Klinger had one copy of that and I had another copy of that, we would have never known that those were alternate takes until we actually listened to them side by side. So I think that's something that this project affords us the opportunity to do, is to compare those. Moving right along into the cataloging portion of the project, we had a full-time staff member who cataloged the cylinders in MARC format. Thankfully, the majority of the cylinders had already been cataloged by the Belfer Lab at Syracuse, and this was a considerable time savings. And these are all in OCLC. Just a couple of quick details on this is our original cataloging rate for all cylinders is about 23%, which is not too bad, actually. It means that Syracuse did a lot of work there. But if you look at blue amberols, that we were, it was actually even higher, that we or lower. We only had to do original cataloging on 7% of our cylinders. But if you look at everything else, it jumps up again, and so we are doing about original cataloging on about 33% of our cylinders. So there is a significant number of cylinders cataloged in OCLC, but the earlier you go, the less there are. And now I'm going to turn it over to Noah, and he's going to kind of walk you through the transfer process that he did, going from cleaning and selecting styluses, and give you an outline of what he did over the past couple of years.
Well, hello, everyone. David recently called me out of my cylinder lair to give a talk today about the digitization process that I've been involved in here the last couple of years. And so I guess I'd like to start by discussing, these are all the things I'll soon talk about, but basically the cleanup process physically, stylus selection, the actual transferring of the cylinder, subsequent filtering and cleaning digitally of the cylinder file, metadata entering, file surrogate creation, loading those files on the server, and then the catalog link entering. So we'll see what I can get to here in the next couple minutes. Here's a picture of me that was put on here without my permission. Basically, this is the stacks of the cylinders after they've been boxed and then cataloged. I would be taking them and right before transferring, subjecting most of them to a cleaning regimen. And this cleaning solution that we used was originally designed by the Library of Congress. It's a mix of fungicide, detergent, and ammonia, which we like to call bug juice around the office. Don't ask me why. But what I found over about 6,500 cylinders was that the celluloid in particular were very conducive to being cleaned. There, I don't know what that exactly was, but I think the chemical composition seemed that it responded well. If you cleaned it off the residue or dirt, it would end up playing back with greater clarity typically. Not all the time, but that seemed generally to be the case. Whereas with wax cylinders, there's much more careful to clean. A lot of the wax cylinders that we ended up putting on the website were very dirty, soiled, moldy cylinders. And in fact, it seemed like when you use this cleaning solution, you actually made the sound quality worse, like that you were actually grinding the grooves into the dirt, or the dirt into the grooves. And as far as brown wax is concerned, we didn't clean those at all due to their fragile nature. So once the cylinders have been cleaned or not cleaned, the styli were selected. And basically, we used about four or five styli for a particular cylinder media throughout the project, and we used those uniformly. But our selection process involved purchasing numerous styli from expert stylists based on research conducted by the Edison National Historic Site, and our very systematic selection process involved taking all these styli and trying them on a whole lot of different cylinders and seeing which one sounded best. David and I had a series of listening tests, and at the end of the period of time, we determined, we had picked out our several styli for use in the project. And here are two that we used. I'll let you be the judge which one we used and which one we didn't. So now we're ready for the transfer process itself. Basically, here's a lot of technical information for those of you who are inclined, but suffice to say, the important things to realize are this machine here is an Archaea phone, and this is a machine that we used throughout the project, and it performed beautifully over 6,500 transfers. And on the right, the PC, which we captured the sound from the Archaea phone, and in wave editing software with a Sound Deluxe sound card. And that's the long and short of it. So after transfer, we have a unedited, raw wave transfer that we would end up putting up on the website that anyone could download as well and edit as they pleased. But we felt that it would be nice to actually have a cleaned up version as well. And the reasons for this are several. The first is we actually had a lot of complaints in the pilot project from people who they really liked the cylinders, but they felt that they were too noisy. So they said that if we could do something about the noise, that would be great. And secondly, we believe that this might be a great opportunity to really show just how nice the sound of some cylinder media can be, especially those cylinders that are in excellent condition. And I'll show you that later here in the talk. So part of the process involved this filtering, specifically the application of a high-pass filter. And in WaveLab, that's called a Q filter. I don't know why. One kind of noise that you find a lot in cylinders in general, and especially in celluloid cylinders, Edison Blue Ambrels in particular, is what I call the bump. And the bump is this kind of boobada-boobada sound that you get from cylinders that are out of round and that have been warped and warping over the last 90 years or so, give or take. So you have this more elliptical cylinder, and what ends up happening is you get a low bass rumble. And here you can actually see we've done a spectral analysis of a Edison Blue Ambrel. So those big peaks in the middle there, I love the colors here. The peaks in the middle are the audible Edison Blue Ambrel, the section that you're able to hear. And you can actually see on the left there, this is an unedited, unfiltered cylinder. On the left is kind of a lower relief. I guess you could say they're the Appalachian Mountains to the Himalayas of the audible cylinder. But what we did with the Q filter then is right about 180 hertz. Here, I can demonstrate. What you end up getting is a greatly reduced bump. And I think actually it worked pretty well, and we ended up applying it throughout the project for all the cylinders. We actually did some listening tests with lower voiced instruments, bass, cello, and baritone voice, for instance. And we found that by and large, the loss of musical signal with the application of the Q filter was virtually negligible. So we felt pretty confident about that. So after the Q filter application, we did some cleanup with Cedar. They're wonderfully named D-Clicker, D-Crackler, D-Hisser, and D-Buzzer, which remove click, crackle, hiss, and buzz. So these are the units, they're hardware units, and I would manipulate them and these knobs here and play back each cylinder the raw wave transfer. And hopefully out would come a more clean sounding cylinder file. So basically a little bit about kind of my philosophy of this, which is that overall I was fairly conservative which is, you can't say too much about me. But here I was very conservative in terms of the cleanup. And I think the reason why is that we felt that it would be very valuable to have a cylinder that would be have noise removed, but yet still preserve the quality of the original. And you can, well, let me play this sound file and give you a taste. When it worked well, I think it worked pretty well. But here's a file, and then I can talk about it a little bit. This is Gondolier by Fred Van Epps. Click on this. All right, hopefully this works. Stop. Two things are notable about this file. One is that it's fairly clear of click and crackle, and I found that the cedar equipment really handled the removal of those two things quite well, and without sacrificing the original kind of quality of the cylinder. It has a lot of noise in terms of the hiss, and actually that's where the conservative quality of the cleanup comes in. And so it kept a lot of hiss, but overall it did a pretty good job. So we have now a cleaned up cylinder file in addition to the raw wave transfer. And at the end of the whole process, we ended up with a total of 6 files per cylinder, which worked out to about 40,000 total files, at least 2 terabytes of data. And basically, the ones to be concerned with here are the B file. Our naming convention, you can kind of see on the right, A, B, C, D, and E, and F in the suffix of the cylinder files. But the B files was the most important to the user, because this was the file that would be used to spin off C, D, E, and F. And to those users who wanted to listen to a cylinder, the ones that they would be interested in would be the MP3 downloadable D and the QuickTime file F. And the other ones we actually had on the server, but we didn't end up serving up on the site. And here is where metadata became of primary importance. And what ended up happening is just to enter simple things that pertain to recording, like title and artist, year. We had to end up using several different wave editing programs. We used both WaveLab and SoundForge. And then to add something as basic as Composer, we had to make the MP3 first and then enter the Composer into the ID3 tags of the MP3. So it really points out that there's a lot of inconsistency in metadata possibilities in wave editing programs and other just tag editing programs. So I'd like to pass it back to David to talk about the website, whose creation I don't understand whatsoever.
I'm not sure I understand it either, as you can see from this picture. Patrick, how much time do I have? Just 5 minutes. That's perfect. We originally planned to get the website online about 6 months after the project started. We were shooting for summer of 2004, and we had to hire programming staff and all that kind of stuff. We just sort of kept putting it off. I should say I kept putting it off and putting it off and putting it off. Finally, summer of 2005 rolls around, and the grant is ending in October. We don't have a website yet. We've got all these cylinders that are transferred, and we really needed to start working on this. So we started looking to, and part of this was just internal systems problems in any large organizations like ours, where we originally had a commitment from the library that we would do this in-house, and then it became clear to me that wasn't going to happen. So I sort of rearranged funds plans and shifted things around and ended up hiring a programmer for 3 months to work on this. In the end, we did get it done. I think it actually works pretty good, and it follows the model that we originally done. And what goes on here with the, you might, if you go to the site, you might just think you're looking at one server. And in fact, there's 4 or 5 different servers that are running this. And if you can hear me, I'll walk down here. That's kind of a rough overview of the architecture of the site, and gives you an idea that it's a little more complicated than, say, putting a web server up in your closet with a bunch of audio files on it. But that's that. Okay. We went online on I think November 16th, 1995, and actually our publicity campaign consisted of 2 email messages, one to the ARSC listserv and one to the MLA listserv. And from then, it basically all hell broke loose. John Noring then posted it to Slashdot, and it appeared on Slashdot that weekend. And that first weekend, our servers went down. I don't remember exactly, but we had over 1 million page views that weekend. And we've had significant media attention. And somehow, the Cylinders just, I think we were right in this, that Cylinders sort of capture people's attention in the way that putting Bing Crosby 78s online wouldn't have done. And we've had a lot of coverage and a lot of web traffic, including New York Times, Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, and other places. We've had great radio coverage, NPR, BBC, and the CBC. I think partly is that radio just loves anything to do with audio. And I think half this room's been on NPR in the past couple of months. Sam and Patrick here, and I heard Tim the other day. And they just love anything to do with audio. So that's been great publicity. And then the real stealth thing here that we didn't know about was that it was really the blogs that really pushed us over the top here. We got written up in hundreds of blogs eventually, but a couple of them, significant ones early on, that just spread throughout the net, and pretty soon, half the internet seemed to know about our site. And just a kind of an overview of the web traffic we've had in the past 5 or 6 months. Since November, we've had 6 million page views on the website, And just maybe about 3 or 4 weeks ago, we passed 1 million downloads for MP3 files. And then there's WAV files as well. The WAVs, I couldn't believe that anybody would want to download a WAV file, but they do. They pulled 100,000 of them off our sites. So we've actually served up, you can see down in the size at the, on the left, it says 5.5. That's about 5.5 terabytes of data that we've served out from the library servers over the past 6 months. And in the bottom graphic there, you can see the sort of a time statistics there. The first huge spike is Slashdot back in November. And you can see that on that, that's a two-day spike there, Saturday and Sunday, where we were getting 1 million hits a day on the website. And then in March was when the New York Times article came out, which was above the fold in the arts section on the Sunday paper. And that just about did us. I was skiing that weekend, and when I got back into cell phone range, my phone just started furiously beeping with all the messages from systems people about the library not being able to check out books anymore and things like that. It's been fun, actually, but we think we're through the worst of it, but you can see there on the right that the baseline traffic of the website has increased substantially. The lessons learned, Patrick Tweesh, should I just skip this?
About a minute.
I'll just skip that, but project staff, lessons learned. I can print this out and set it on the back, and you can talk to me about it later if you want. We did learn a lot on this, and I think there's a lot of further research in Columbia Cylinders echo, all of them do. I think it's a stylus size issue, but I don't know. And
you go back adjacent groove echo or the groove echo?
No, I think it's an adjacent groove
adjacent
echo.
Groove. Yeah, right. Yeah.
Because I think the grooves are narrow and the stylus is picking up adjacent grooves. But I don't know. It happens on acoustic machines, too. If you play a Columbia Cylinder on an Edison acoustic machine, it gets an echo. Anyway. This project is a collaboration. Anything like this is not the work of a single individual, even two individuals. Noah and I did a lot of the work on this and have been collaborating on this project really for 4 years, but it's a collaboration. And as you can see, there were a lot of people in my library that were involved in this project. And a lot of people in ours who gave, I can't tell you how many phone calls I've had with Bill Klinger where he's given us advice. Also our donors I'd like to thank because a lot of people have been sending us cylinders for digitization, including Bill Shirk from Bowling Green State University and Gene Deanna from Library of Congress have both contributed to the project, so we'd like to thank them. And if you have any further questions, feel free to give us a call or drop us an email. Thank you.